Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert resigned today. Wow, at this rate, Trump's going to run out of people who want to work in the White House, and he's going to have to hire Hillary Clinton himself.
So what do you want to be in charge of?
All of it. I'll take care of all of it.
Thank you. I really appreciate this.
Hi, welcome to the Late Night with Seth Meyers podcast. My name is Henry Melcher, and I'm a producer at the show. It is only Wednesday, but of course, there is no shortage of news. This week, we learned that the FBI raided the offices of Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen. There are also many questions about what President Trump plans to do in Syria. And these are just some of the stories that Seth covers in The Closer Look. After that, Seth has a really great conversation with LGBTQ activist Sarah McBride. She has a new book out called Tomorrow Will Be Different, and I was lucky enough to continue the conversation with her backstage exclusively for this podcast. But first, please enjoy Seth taking a closer look at the current state of the Mueller probe.
Yesterday, we saw one of the most extraordinary moments of Donald Trump's presidency when the FBI raided the offices of his personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, and in response, Trump has completely lost his mind. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. It's hard to imagine how Donald Trump could be in more legal jeopardy than he is right now. Basically, Trump has more legal problems than Conor McGregor and just as many concussions. And yet, somehow, things got much worse yesterday for Trump.
Tonight, a dramatic FBI raid at the New York office and hotel room of Michael Cohen, the president's personal attorney who paid off adult film star Stormy Daniels for her silence about her alleged affair with Mr. Trump.
The New York Times also reporting that the FBI also seized emails, tax documents, and business records, and that the records include communications between Michael Cohen, the president's attorney, and President Trump.
Federal prosecutors in Manhattan obtained search warrants after a referral from special counsel Robert Mueller, who found evidence of a potential crime.
Wow. So just to recap, the FBI, an organization Trump has attacked for months, raided the office of Michael Cohen, his longtime personal fixer, and seized tax documents, which he has repeatedly refused to release, related to campaign finance violations during the election involving Stormy Daniels, the porn star he allegedly had an affair with, on a referral from Robert Mueller, the special counsel in the Russia investigation. This is like the series finale of a TV show where they try to tie all the different plot lines together. You're watching, like, oh, it's Michael Cohen from season one. What's he doing in this episode? Oh! Trump ever goes on trial, they're going to call characters from previous episodes into the courtroom like the last episode of Seinfeld.
Oh, no, Anthony Scaramucci, what did I do to you? No mooch for you.
Of course, when news like this breaks, we can always count on our calm, rational president to react in a measured way, and he once again rose to the occasion this morning when he got up bright and early and tweeted these reassuring words to a nation in turmoil. Attorney-client privilege is dead. And then, less than a minute later, he added this helpful follow-up, a total witch hunt. So the Fed seized Trump's communications with his lawyers, and the next morning, Trump woke up and screamed, attorney-client privilege is dead. What is Trump's strategy here? To act so guilty, the feds will think he has to be innocent? You know, the insanity defense only works after you've been arrested, right?
They can't arrest me if I'm crazy. Quick, somebody get me a diaper I can wear as a hat.
Now, Michael Cohen isn't just a peripheral player in Trump's world. He's been Trump's loyal fixer for years, and he's as close to Trump's inner circle as you can possibly get. And last month, as the controversy surrounding the Stormy Daniels story was intensifying, Cohen insisted that he would remain forever loyal to his boss and that the hush payment he allegedly paid went beyond politics. He told Vanity Fair, people are mistaking this for a thing about the campaign. What I did defensively for my personal client and my friend is what attorneys do for their high-profile clients. I would have done it in 2006. I would have done it in 2011. I truly care about him and the family more than just as an employee and attorney. Yeah, it's just a thing a friend does for a friend. Like when your buddy forgets his wallet, so you pay for his coffee, except instead of coffee, it's a porn star, and instead of forgetting his wallet, he forgot his wedding vows. And say what you will about Donald Trump, but he is a man who respects and appreciates loyalty. A friend like that deserves nothing less than mutual admiration and devotion. So naturally, Trump did what he does to all of his most loyal servants. He immediately threw him under the bus. That's right. He said, ask Michael Cohen, and it looks like the FBI said, okay. Now, suffice to say, the fact that federal prosecutors obtained a warrant to raid the offices of the president's personal attorney and seize communications with the president is a huge deal. It's incredibly rare and must meet a high legal burden. And while the exact details of the warrant are still unknown, yesterday we started to learn more about which potential crimes investigators might be looking into.
Michael Cohen, the longtime attorney of President Trump, is under federal investigation for possible bank fraud, wire fraud, and campaign finance violations.
Wow, it's amazing how many different crimes the Trump team has been able to cover. You got Cohen on bank fraud, wire fraud, and campaign finance violations, Paul Manafort on failing to register as a foreign agent, Michael Flynn on lying to the FBI, and Jared Kushner for, I don't know, probably using a fake ID. Hi, I'm 21. I work at the White House. I'd like to buy some beer, please. Do you have to buy six, or can you get one or two? And here's a fun fact I learned yesterday. Michael Cohen's office, the one that was raided by the FBI, is actually located at 30 Rockefeller Plaza. That's the building we're in right now, the one we tape this show in every day. I feel like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. Everything I was looking for was right there with me all along. Michael Cohen was very much the keeper of Trump's most closely held secrets, and the fact that FBI raided his office and seized his communications with Trump is being taken by outside lawyers as a sign of just how serious the investigation is. One lawyer told the Washington Post, you can't get much worse than this other than arresting someone's wife for putting pressure on a family member. This strikes at the inner sanctum. Your lawyer, your CPA, your barber, your therapist, your bartender. All the people who would know the worst about you. And if there's anyone who knows the worst about Trump, it's his barber. Cohen may very well know more about Donald Trump than any other being on the planet, which might explain why, in his first comments to the media yesterday after the story broke, Trump seemed to come totally unglued. He was supposed to meet with his national security team to discuss Syria, but completely unprompted, he began the meeting by attacking the FBI.
So I just heard that they broke into the office of one of my personal attorneys.
They broke in? They're the FBI. They had a search warrant. That's like waking up from surgery and telling your doctor, you stole my appendix. Trump once again aired one of his long simmering grievances, his anger at Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who recused himself from the Russia investigation because he has misled Congress and because he had been a part of the campaign that was being investigated. Trump wants someone in charge who will exert influence over the probe and potentially shut it down, and he made that clear again yesterday.
The Attorney General made a terrible mistake when he did this and when he recused himself, or he should have certainly let us know if he was going to recuse himself, and we would have put a different attorney general in.
I shudder to imagine who else Trump would have named as attorney general. Chris Christie, Rudy Giuliani, an Amazon Echo that only watches Fox News?
Hillary, Obama,
deep state,
witch hunt,
emails.
Trump was so panicked and flustered when he spoke to the media that he just kept mindlessly repeating the same words over and over.
It's a disgraceful situation. It's a disgrace. It's frankly a real disgrace. I think it's a disgrace. It's a disgrace. It's a disgrace. I think it's a disgrace. I think it's disgraceful. It's a disgrace.
Hey, man, if you're not going to bother to read the Constitution, could you at least check out a thesaurus? You look at what's going on, it's ignominious. Oh, okay. I'm going to be proud of that. One of the most unsettling things about Trump's comments was they were made at a meeting where Trump was supposed to be deciding whether to use military force against Syria. In fact, sitting next to him was his new national security advisor, John Bolton. And Trump noted the awkward timing of his arrival.
John, I want to thank you very much. This is going to be a lot of work. Interesting day. He picked today as his first day. So, generals, I think he picked the right day.
No, he didn't. This is like starting your job at Enron on the day of the crash. Oh, you must be the new guy. Here, grab a shredder. This is one of the most consequential and potentially most perilous moments of the Trump presidency. One of his closest confidants is in the crosshairs of the FBI, and he's openly threatening to shut down the special counsel's investigation. And if that happens, I can think of at least one word I'd use to describe the situation.
It's a disgrace, disgrace, disgrace.
This has been A Closer Look. Our guest is an LGBTQ advocate and the National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign. Her book, Tomorrow Will Be Different, Love, Loss, and the Fight for Trans Equality is available now. Please welcome to the show, Sarah McBride, everyone. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we first sort of got introduced to you. I know this is the first time I saw you. You spoke at the 2016 Democratic Convention. You were 25 years old, is that right?
I was, yes.
You were the first transgender person to ever speak at a convention. Very exciting. But this was pretty much, this had been decided years ago. This is, you wanted to be speaking at political events.
I did. So when I was about 11 years old, I asked my parents for a podium for Christmas. And they fortunately got it for me. So I've been practicing for the convention for about 12 years. I asked them at one point for a teleprompter. But they realized that they'd have to hire a teleprompter operator, so yeah, they nixed that idea.
Yeah, and then there'd just be a weird guy living in the house.
Right. Living in my bedroom, not work out well.
So, you know, I think we talk a lot, and it's healthy because we're talking about transgender issues more, but your book kind of talks about that the transgender community is full of people, just like everybody else, and who have the same complex issues that all people have. Was that something that you tried to address? Is that something you set out to do?
Yeah, well, with the convention and with this book, I wanted to make sure that people understood that behind this national conversation on trans rights are real people who love and laugh, hope and dream, fear and cry just like everyone else. And this is the story of my own journey as a transgender woman and as an advocate, but also the story of my relationship with my late husband, Andy, who was a transgender man and advocate. And I wanted people to enter into that conversation to understand that transgender people quite simply are people.
You mentioned, yes. You mentioned your partner, Andy. You very sadly, tragically lost him to cancer. What was it like revisiting that in the writing of this book?
So I met Andy Cray, who was an attorney and advocate, just a couple weeks after I came out at a White House Pride reception under the Obama administration, not under the Trump administration.
Yeah, that's happening less.
It's not happening anymore. And I quickly fell in love with him. He was an incredible person with an incredible sense of humor. He was diagnosed with cancer just a couple months after we started dating. He went through treatment, and then he got the news that every patient fears. His cancer was back, and it was terminal. So we got married 3 weeks after that diagnosis, and then just a couple days after that, he passed away. And I think in many ways, I sort of jumped back into advocacy after he passed, and I didn't let myself grieve. Mm-hmm. So writing this book for me was a healing process. It allowed me to sort of take stock in the emotions and the experiences that I had, but also it was my way of sort of living those experiences and living those lessons again and really finding hope again, because I wrote it after the election and I wasn't feeling too good after the election.
Well, I'm glad you found some hope again on behalf of all of us. Yeah. I also want to talk about this administration, obviously they are doing a lot to roll back the advancements that happened during the Obama administration. Certainly this transgender military ban is just one example. Yet at the same time, we are seeing more transgender people. There's a lot more of them in the media. There's a lot more of them telling their story like you. Do you feel like the cultural change will ultimately catch up and surpass anything political that's being put in your way?
Yeah, I think what we've seen over the last couple years is that every single time anti-equality politicians come for us and come for the transgender community, we end up coming for them on Election Day. We end up having a conversation with the country that serves to open hearts and change minds. And with each attack, we end up getting stronger in the end. And I think we saw that in North Carolina when mm-hmm. we defeated Pat McCrory after he passed HB2, that hateful law that banned transgender people from using restrooms consistent with our gender identity. And I think we're seeing that now, that our stories and our voices and our lives will continue to open hearts and move equality forward no matter who is president.
That is wonderful to hear. You got Joe Biden.
Yes.
Joe Biden wrote your foreword. You were from Delaware, so very exciting. Obviously, when you first met Joe Biden, how did that go down?
Well, I was about 11 years old, and I walked into a pizza shop with my parents, and Joe Biden was sitting there, and Joe Biden came in from the Amtrak, because he actually rode the Amtrak yeah. every single day to Dover.
You better.
Or to Washington. And he came in, and I looked up at him with my mouth completely open. And
did you have the podium, or was the podium
at
all?
The podium, it was not travel. Yeah. Although I did dress up as a podium for Christmas
okay,
one year.
Great.
Or for Halloween one year. He kneeled down and he looked in my eyes and he wrote on a piece of paper. He said, "Remember me when you're president," which I'm sure he wrote to every single little kid at 11. But,
well, yeah, he wants to play the odds.
Right, yeah right.
Well, that's fantastic. And it's so lovely that he wrote the foreword. And it's so lovely to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Really appreciate it. Sarah McBride, everybody, tomorrow will be different. It's available now.
Hi, this is Henry from Late Night. I'm here with Sarah McBride. Activist, spokesperson, now author.
Yes. Author. Unbelievable.
I wanted to ask you something that really kind of stands out in the book. You write about being a young trans kid and dealing with a feeling of overwhelming homesickness.
Right.
What does that mean to cisgender people who don't know that feeling?
Well, I think one of the challenges we have in the fight for trans equality, which is different than the fight for gay rights, mm-hmm. is that most people who are straight understand what it feels like to love and to lust. So they can enter into conversations around mm-hmm. sexual orientation with a degree of empathy that allows them to sort of feel passion for those issues. But on the issue of trans identities, most people who aren't transgender don't have an analogous experience.
Right.
And so for me, the closest thing that I could compare it to was a constant feeling of homesickness, mm-hmm. that unwavering ache in the pit of my stomach that would only go away when I could be seen and affirmed as myself.
Right. So the solution to homesickness in many ways is to go home. So what was your process of going home? What does that feel like? What is that? What's that journey?
Well, I think it's the journey of finally being seen in your full humanity, uh-huh. of finally being respected in who you've always been. I remember when I finally came out and started living authentically, people would ask me, am I happy? And, it was always asked with the best intentions, but I didn't transition to be happy. I transitioned to feel and be free to feel every emotion. Mm-hmm. And that's what it felt like. It was sort of, my mind was finally free to think about everything else in the world, not just my gender identity anymore.
Right. You also talk about, we were chatting about this earlier, this speaks to your characters, that when you were younger, you felt like you could never maybe feel free, but you wanted to fight for people to feel that way. I'm wondering now, when you talk to young kids, young trans kids, how they feel about these issues, if there is more of an optimism and hope at a young age now.
One of the incredible things about my job is that I get to meet a lot of trans youth. And when I was growing up, it seemed like my dreams and my identity were mutually exclusive. Uh-huh. But now I get to meet across the country transgender youth who are both living their truth and dreaming big dreams all at the same time. And that is such a transformational change. And to see these young people who want to be presidents and actors and astronauts. I met a transgender girl, 11-year-old transgender girl, who wants to be an astronaut when she grows up. The fact that they are literally reaching for the stars is truly inspiring. And it shows that we've transformed impossibility into possibility into reality. Mm-hmm. And for me, if we've done it before, then I know we can do it again.
It's inspiring to hear that's happening right now with the backdrop of this political moment we're in, where the White House and leaders across the country, in many ways, are rolling back trans protections and trans rights. It's exciting to hear that on the ground you are seeing people and talking to people that feel a hope and to feel an energy. And a lot of that was put forward by the Obama administration. Can you talk about your work with the administration?
Sure. Well, you know, I had the chance right after I came out, actually, to intern in the Obama White House. And I worked on a number of issues, including LGBTQ equality in the White House. And that started my work then later on at the Center for American Progress and now at the Human Rights Campaign, advocating for LGBTQ equality and working with this administration to achieve equality. And over their 8 years, we saw sea change on LGBTQ rights. And since the last election, though, we've gone from that presidency of progress to a presidency of prejudice. And at every turn, Donald Trump has tried to undermine and attack the rights and dignity of transgender people. Mm. But at the end of the day, while he'll roll back some of the advancements under the Obama administration, he won't succeed on every single one. And the hearts and minds that were open during those 8 years, they will not close.
Right. And you were just chatting with Seth about how culturally these shifts are so much bigger and more powerful than whatever they may be doing to push things in the other direction, which is a really hopeful thing to think about as we kind of move forward. You helped fight for a lot of change in Delaware, and you write about this a lot in the book. Can you talk about your work in Delaware?
Sure. So, you know, when I graduated from college after coming out as transgender, I was faced with a decision that no one should have to make, but one that is all too common for LGBTQ people. The decision between going home to the place I love or being safe and secure. Delaware law at the time wouldn't allow me to have both. Because at that time, Delaware was one of a majority of states that still lacked clear and explicit protections from discrimination for transgender people, which meant we were at risk of being fired from our jobs, kicked out of our homes, denied services simply because of who we are. And that legal reality remains in place today, that a majority of states still lack those protections.
Still a majority of states.
Still a majority of states and the federal government still lack clear protections from discrimination for LGBTQ people writ large. And, you know, day in and day out, we went down to the legislature, we told our stories, and we demonstrated what I told Seth, which is that behind this conversation are real people who love and laugh, hope and dream, fear and cry, just like everyone else. And in doing that, in allowing them to see us in our full humanity, they could no longer look us in the eye and deny us the equal protection of the laws they swore to uphold.
Yeah. And is that kind of the message you have to activists around the country, is just tell human stories and just get in front of people and have conversations? Is that kind of the way to drive change?
It's one way. It's one way. I mean, I think I've always approached theories of change with the perspective that we need all pressure points.
Right.
We need to go in and we need to have those conversations to tap into, you know, those politicians who maybe have empathy. not all politicians will be reachable that way.
Yeah. They don't all have empathy.
Right. They don't. That's so, right. Yeah. They are certainly lacking in it towards specific groups of people in this
absolutely.
Country.
Absolutely. Right.
And so we need to go in and we need to tell our stories. We need to open those hearts and change those minds, not just in the public, but in state legislatures and in Congress. But also, of course, that's not going to reach everyone. So we need to organize and mobilize. We need to protest. We need to turn out and vote. We need to demonstrate that there's political power behind these powerful stories.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the activism you've been doing throughout your entire life. Thank you for writing this really beautiful book. And thank you for being here. It was such a pleasure meeting you and getting to chat with you today.
Such an honor. Thank you very much for having me.
We're thrilled to have you.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
I love a good parasocial relationship with a celebrity who will probably never know my name.
I mean, honestly, who knows? Don't count yourself out. But my favorite part about these feuds is how they're ignited by the tiniest things.
Jada, I love you. G.I. Jane 2, can't wait to see it.
I accidentally laminated my brows too much.
It starts small and then it gets so big.
Be honest, Naomi, I'm fearful of you to this day.
I don't know her.
We all just have to admit, we're addicted. Everybody has opinions. Everyone picks sides.
Leave Britney Spears alone right now.
From Wondery, I'm Sydney Battle.
And I'm Matt Bellassai.
And this is Dis and Tell, la, 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 where we unpack why we get so invested in these feuds and whether or not our attention only makes the whole thing worse.
Follow Dis and Tell wherever you get your podcasts.